Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNRadio.com/Behind the Badge.
Let's get it going with Blockbuster Blake Stubbs. Blockbuster, is that how you want to be referred to, by the way? We've been on the air before, and I never considered, is that really like, should I refer to you, is that your first name? Hey, Blockbuster, can I just call you that?
You know what, we can roll with that if you like.
I like Blockbuster Blake Stubbs, don't get me wrong, but I think it'd be sort of cool if I go, hey, Blockbuster, what's up?
You know what? I'm only going to answer to that name when you say it. Exclusive nickname for me. I love it. I love it.
Well, you know, I love talking about the movies with you. And I know that you've seen the Avatar, There's More Water Than Anybody Wants movie, and Fablemans. And as luck would have it, so have I.
Excellent.
Because over the holidays, my wife and I paid good money to go see Avatar in 3D. And then you and I had talked previously about how the box office for Spielberg's Fablemans was not, there wasn't a lot of box office. In fact, there wasn't even a lot of distribution. Remember, we couldn't find the movie.
Right.
We had to go look for the movie. Well, all
it was
of a
struggle.
It popped up on my pay-per-view at home.
Yeah.
And I'm like, honey, come here, look at this. I mean, it was like 1995, but I figure, you know, if I went to see it at the movie theater, it'd be at least that much. Plus, if I decided to get popcorn, it'd be $100. So, you know, well, let's talk about those. We're going to break in about, I don't know, 3 minutes or so. I want to talk about the Fablemans and the Avatars and the movies that are coming out now. And I'll look down the road a bit because I'm not sure that, because with all the additions of the streaming services, it certainly used to be that January, February, and most of March was where they dumped the movies they didn't think were going to make it in the year before. So we'll take a look at that. What do you want to start with first?
Tell you what, let's first kick off with the Fablemans, because we both wanted to see that last month, but we had to obviously wait.
Right.
And it was quite disappointing that the distribution of the film was, I want to use the word muddled, because it was playing in a lot of areas, but it wasn't playing where I live.
Right.
It was going to be a huge hurdle for you to get to go see it. But once it finally, you know, started to sort of spread out in terms of its distribution, which was kind of odd because it's a Steven Spielberg film. And I was so curious to know what his partially autobiographical film was going to end up looking like. You know, I mean, I wanted to see what I feel is one of our greatest visual storytellers would do with his own story. And essentially, that's what The Fablemans is. Now, obviously, the names have been changed to protect the innocent, so to speak. But Steven Spielberg, working with Tony Kushner, who he has collaborated with multiple times, brilliant and very accomplished writer, they got together and sort of took some of the best and biggest moments of Spielberg's young life and constructed a 2.5-hour semi-autobiographical film that to me sort of gave us a little bit of a peek behind the curtain, so to speak, at the man himself, Steven Spielberg. I want to open up by simply saying that I absolutely was a total sap for this movie. It sucked me in. Now, John, I don't know if you had the same reaction, but for whatever reason, I was hoping to get sort of again, that little peek behind the curtain, but also I wanted to see all of Spielberg's greatest hits between his camera movements that he loves to do, working again with Janusz Kaminski, which I've lost track of how many collaborations they've had, but ever since Schindler's List, they've been working together. Obviously, you've got a John Williams score in there. This is really kind of like Spielberg getting really personal. Even though, once you finish watching this movie, knowing that so much of it is based on things that really did happen for him, he's been sprinkling the Fablemans throughout his entire career in his filmography. which is, I think, why it sucked me in so much, because I'm a big Spielberg guy. I'm a big fan. And on top of reviewing some of his films, I really did. He took me with this one. I couldn't help it. What do you think?
I will tell you when we come back right after this break. 17 minutes after 7 with John Landecker, 720 WGN, talking to Blockbuster Blake Stubbs about movies. We're in the middle of a conversation about The Fablemans, which we both saw. Blake wanted to know what I thought about it before the break, and now we're back, and so I'm going to tell you. And it's going to be a little difficult for me to explain, because there was an extremely personal connection that I had with this film that I never saw coming. And I'll try to put it in context, and it may apply to some other people. I don't know. I was at in Chicago working at WLS. I came here about 1972, and I'd always been interested in movies, always, from day one. And I don't know, somewhere around 75, 76, I decided that I would embark on making home movies with Super 8 millimeter film. And these were tiny, they were small reels of film that you would buy at the photo store, usually Kodak, in a square yellow box. If you wanted to edit these films into any kind of storyline, you would have to buy an editor that would have, you'd put the movie reel on, the exposed reel on one end of it, and then run it through a viewer and bring it up and hand crank frame by frame by frame. If you wanted to edit it, you had to take literally a razor blade and cut the film. And then to put it back together, in the days when Steven Spielberg did that, which I imagine must have been about 10 years before I did, they used a glue with a brush. By the time I got to it, it was splicing tabs, I believe was the name of it. And then, if you wanted to provide any kind of music with these films, since they weren't sound on film, you would attempt to, on a reel-to-reel tape recorder, record some sort of music or whatever and play it along with the Super 8 film. When the young Fableman went through that exact process, my jaw was on the floor. I mean, I was in a whole different zone after that. It was, I mean, maybe there were other people who did that, you know, but I told my daughter Amy about it, and she goes, well, that certainly reminds me of somebody I know. So I guess that really contributed to my enjoyment of that movie.
See, that's incredible to hear, John, because the whole time I was watching the movie, I knew I was going to be in for some kind of treat. You know what I mean? Like, I just knew that there was going to be something there that was going to draw me in. And it kind of happened pretty early in the film. And it was really with the young actor playing Sammy Fableman, the younger Spielberg, when he finally stepped in and they had done the jump in time, because you meet him when he's a very young man, a little boy, and playing around with the family camera and everything. And of course, the bit with the train crashing, and I'm not spoiling too much other than to say they go to the movie opens with him seeing his first film. And if you know and have watched a lot of Q&As that Spielberg has done over the years, which a great deal of them are on YouTube, you can watch interviews with him where he tells stories of what it was like growing up and all this. A lot of it ends up in this movie. And the thing that I really connected with was that he was really trying to romanticize a life that he's processed at this point. And for me, there's a line in the movie Moneyball where Brad Pitt, it says it multiple times in the film, where it's really hard not to be romantic about baseball. And while I am a sports fan, for me, it's really hard for me not to be romantic about movies.
I hear you.
And so this movie, with that thought, this movie really sucked me in with that. And again, with excellent performances, Michelle Williams playing his mother really blew me away, if I'm being honest. And I know that there's only a few clips that you could see of the woman herself, but when he won the Oscar for Schindler's List, he thanked his mother. She was in the audience. And when the camera cut to her, her laugh and her mannerisms, it just – it felt like I had seen this person before, and it's because I had. I had seen the clip of his mother in the audience at the Oscars years ago. I also want to say that I thought that Seth Rogen did a very admirable job. Excellent performance from him. Judd Hirsch comes in like a tornado and leaves and is fantastic. This movie is loaded with great acting on top of excellent craft and filmmaking. And again, this is a very personal story from one of what I feel is one of our greatest visual storytellers. So, and I can't ignore Paul Dano, who plays his father, Bert Fableman, who is the absolute contrast of his mother. And that's something that, again, when you watch a lot of his films, you realize that he has always been sprinkling a lot of himself into those films. But now he's made a film that sort of shows you why.
Yeah.
And I think that if you go into the movie knowing that, you're going to enjoy it. And also, I just want to throw out there that there's a particular cameo at the end of the film in what is quite possibly one of, you know, a very great, impactful, funny ending that I'm not going to spoil, but movie fans, if you, I'm not going to pretend you don't already know who's playing this particular person or who the person is, but the way the film ends is a story I had seen Spielberg tell in an interview years ago, and so it was always in the back of my mind, and when that scene starts to unfold, it happens exactly the way he told it. It right. is as funny as his rendition of the story in the interview, but also it leads to what I think is an incredibly funny and kind of a what it's really all about final shot. So, you know, this is a movie that's going to be big come Oscar time, I think, for a multitude of reasons. But also, I think it's one of those movies that it's unfortunate that it wasn't so widely released right away. So if you have to track this movie down, I highly recommend that people do it.
Well, you know, I don't buy very many movies, but when this is available, it's one that I'm buying. I'm talking to Blockbuster Blake Stubbs about films at 7:24, 7:20 WGN. Let's move on to Avatar, The Waterworks, or whatever the whatever this movie is called, which is, how long is that Avatar movie? 3 hours and 33 minutes?
3 hours and 12, yeah.
3:12,
at least at my screening it did.
Right.
But yeah, I also did the big IMAX 3D screening. You know, Avatar The Way of Water is James Cameron's second installment in the Avatar film series, because his intention was always to make, I believe, about six of them. Five or six of them. And we've waited a long time for this one. I believe it's about 13, 14 years. I don't know the exact day or, you know, amount
right,
of days.
Right, but, right.
The long and short of it is if you're wondering why we're getting the sequel now, if you had a chance to go see it, you might understand why, mainly because of the visuals of the film. A lot of the technology that was, you know, utilized to make this movie, again, which, by the way, I've tried to absorb as much understanding as to how they did so much of this, and I still feel like I've barely scratched the surface. Walking out of this movie, I immediately thought, you know what, as far as the story goes, this is a solid continuation of a story that, to be honest, I thought I had kind of forgotten, but I really didn't. You know, all those years ago, because I remember seeing the first film and thinking, wow, visually, that's one of the most incredible things I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And the story was fine. It was easy to follow. You know, the acting was good, but the action and the suspense in certain places, but also the slower, more dramatic beats of the film, like, made a lot of sense. A lot of that's still in play here, I think, with The Way of Water. The big thing for me, though, again, is the visual spectacle. Something about the Avatar films that, you know, I hear a lot of people talk about how they don't like the story too much, or they think it's like an amalgamation of too many things they like. My counterpoint to that argument, and not to really defend the story or go into why I think it's great, because I think it's good, is I think this is one of the few major cinematic events that, despite the fact this film was rated PG-13, almost any age can sit and view and get taken in by this because of the big spectacle, because of the fact that visually it tells its story quite well.
Well, you see, the thing is, that's the whole thing when it comes to my opinion about this Avatar movie was that, to a certain extent, I'd been there and done that before. And the first time I saw the special effects in the original Avatar movie, I was blown away. But these special effects are pretty much along the same lines with the same type of characters and the same type of settings. And it did not make a huge impression on me. I mean, I enjoyed it. I didn't want my money back, but it wasn't like I had ventured into some new brand new universe of special effects, because I'd pretty much seen some of this before. Do you know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah. I think it's more of a, in a lot of ways, technologically, I think they've just upgraded a lot of the tech.
Yeah. Yeah.
Developed some new tech. I watched a brief interview with Jim Cameron talking about, I should say James, I don't know him. James Cameron talking about how, you know, there was a technology that had been developed that the filmmakers had seen demoed at one point, and they found a way to incorporate and enhance whatever that technology was.
Right.
A great deal of it had to do with the water.
Mm-hmm.
And look, if you're familiar with James Cameron's filmography, you know the man loves him some water.
Oh, boy, does he ever. I think the guy's got
Titanic.
I think he has a water fetish of some kind. I'm not quite sure what it is.
and his own trek to the bottom of the Mariana Trench. I mean, you know, there's a documentary about that. So, look, I think that it's safe to say that visually this movie is spectacular.
Indeed.
I don't want to back away from saying that I think you're onto something there, John, where, you know, like maybe you weren't as impressed as you were the first time, because this is a continuation, and while clearly the visuals have upgraded, you know, certain things look more photorealistic than they did in the first film. It definitely, you know, it has solid acting. It's got a decent enough continuation of its original story, despite the fact that there's a time chasm, so to speak, which the film also adheres to, because our main character, Jake Sully, has a whole family now. They have teenagers.
Yep.
So there's a lot to take in with a 3-hour movie, for sure, any 3-hour movie. At least that's your hope. I felt like this was just an easy one to follow, story-wise, which I think was its intention. I think that's by design. And it utilizes actors from the first film that you thought might not reappear, who get to do some exciting work, I think, as far as acting goes. For example, Sigourney Weaver and Stephen Lang both. Weaver playing a teenager in the film, and Stephen Lang playing it's an Avatar version of his original character, except it's, and you find this out very early in the film, he's a clone.
So
he has memories, but he has no sense of, like, identity other than he knows what he needs to do.
Well, listen, I'm sorry to interrupt, because we could go on about this for quite a while, and I would be just fine with me, but we have run out of time, and I want to thank you, Blockbuster Blake Stubbs, for talking again with us here at WGN, and I look forward to the next time.